Chapter 19, December 20th. Gateways. All night, the light had worked the town, and the outriders had patrolled the woods, and the rain had come in endless sheets, and the drums had muttered on. The kids were in a trance, Martin thought at first. Then later, that they were beyond trance. They were in a space that, despite all that had happened to him, he could never reach. From time to time, though, Trevor's hand would come through the dimness and touch his own, and he would know that there are things that never will change, no matter how much we change, that a child needs his parents, that there is love in families that is beyond understanding. In the late hours, he found himself under a pile of little ones, all of whom were trying to be close to the largest male in the place. Mike and George and the other older kids tried to control them, but eventually everybody gave up, and he contented himself with holding the little beings in his arms as best he could. The beauty of mankind touched him, as they did, softly with their little hands, and looked at him with their great admiring eyes. One of them, a little girl called Tilly, who reminded him so much of Winnie that it made his blood ache, said to him, "You have to be our soldier. We need one, and we ain't got one." Her eyes had studied his, and he had felt her mind enter his mind, and it felt like smelling flowers feels, or lying in grass. She'd tossed her head, this tiny, perfect girl, then raised her hand to his cheek and tapped it. "Soldier," she had said. Morning brought new necessities. There were 22 human beings here. They needed food and water. They needed decent sanitation, and children are not good at sanitation. They were growing up fast, but as nobody could leave the tent at night, they used things like an old plastic bucket they'd brought with them, and plastic bags, which they seemed to have in abundance, and these tended to get spilled. They were not modest, the little ones, but the poor teens were desperate for privacy, the boys trying to control their vital young bodies, the girls trying to put them at their ease. It was altogether the kindest, most forgiving, and smelliest group of people Martin had ever known. The roughest dig he'd ever been on did not even begin to compare to this. There were two kids called flap guards who remained at the door of the tent, making certain nobody opened it after dark and, above all, nobody went outside. The drumming was loud enough to drown the sounds generated by the outriders and the nighthawks, so the little ones might cry for their parents, but they did not experience the kind of fear that would have brought the things leaping down on the tent. As the hours slid past, Martin felt more and more trapped in the damned thing. The kids absolutely refused to stop their drumming or go outside even for a few seconds, not until dawn. They wouldn't let him leave either, not that he wanted to. Trevor clung to him. His bevy of little ones did too, and he would never deprive them of that comfort, no matter how illusory he feared that it was. After they had forced Martin into initiation, and to some extent to be transformed himself, he had found Trevor with strange pink sweat on his face and staining his filthy shirt. Martin thought he knew what it was. From the stress of sending his father to face that test, capillaries on the surface of his son's skin had burst. His boy had sweated blood. Over the long night, Martin had tested his new mind and found true changes. He still thought, as he always had, but there was new information, and there were new things he could do with his thought. Trevor had spoken of another world he had seen, a world a lot like this one, but with other people, and no evidence that it was under attack. He had gone through a gateway, he said, and there had read a book, and it was the book of their suffering and the secrets of their days. Martin was familiar with the multiverse concept, of course, and he was aware of the recent discoveries at the Four Empires Super Collider in Switzerland that had suggested that parallel universes were real, but that there would be gateways that you could just walk through. Well, this was going to be interesting to see. There was a stirring in the tent as the sun rose. The drumming became haggard, then stopped. Then it got very quiet. "What's up?" Martin asked Trevor. "I think something's wrong with Wiley. I think the Seraph have broken through to his world," he replied. Martin realized that he could see, in his mind's eye, a shimmer hanging over the Saunders River. It could as easily be a spider web gleaming with dew as an entrance into another universe. He saw also that outriders were pacing there, looking for all the world like enormous tarantulas. They had been designed by the Seraph to strike terror into the human heart, and even seeing them in this way touched him with fear and made them lift their forelegs and eagerly test the air. He withdrew. "Any thoughts, Dad?" "It's a gateway. If it wasn't, it wouldn't be so heavily guarded." "Okay," Pam said. "We're going to take the opportunity to move the tent off this sludge factory, then I'm taking a supplies detail into town." She glanced at Martin. "You stay here." He couldn't disagree with that. Martin followed the others into the kind of morning that comes after great storms, when sunlight washed pure seems to cleanse the world. Golden columns of light marched among the pines, and when they walked out and it fell on Martin, he had a shock, because it was just the sun, but it felt as if somebody was there. A couple of the kids, aware of his thoughts, glanced at him. He was going to have to somehow get used to this lack of inner privacy and the deep sense of belonging that came with it. Gentle, probing fingers seemed to be touching him, the fingers of a being that was deeply accepting of him, of life, of everything. Who was this? Was the sun alive? "It's all alive," Trevor said. "Everything is alive, and everything is conscious. All the stars, all the grass, the trees, every little animal there is. And some of them have high consciousness. The bees do, Dad. When you're in a glade with them, you'll see." "The brain of the bee is microscopic, son, so they couldn't really be all that conscious." Trevor smiled a little. "Just let yourself happen, Dad. You'll be fine." Watching the chaos of kids moving here and there with stakes, with boxes and ropes, singing, laughing, you would never think that they were working together, and carefully organized at that. But they were, and exactly at the moment the tent shuddered and collapsed, four of them came out carrying all the bags and buckets of refuse that had accumulated inside. Not a word was said, as it was rolled and folded and carried off, followed, improbably, by a little boy who was completely overshadowed by the huge cougar's bass drum balanced on his head. Their efforts looked a lot like those of worker bees, Martin thought, and then that a shared mind would, naturally, be far larger than any single component. It hit him then. All mind is shared. That's the way things work. Just surrender to it. Let yourself happen, like Trevor said. "Okay, Dad, let's go." Of course, Trevor could read his thoughts. "Don't let it bother you." "But I can't read you." "Sure you can." He headed off into the caressing sunlight. Following him, Martin did see into his son's thoughts, which were of that gateway and going through it. But that wasn't possible. "Look at the river." "It's possible, Dad, but you have to not think about it and not worry about it. Concentrate your thinking on your body, the way your feet feel as you walk, your hands, every physical sensation." "Why?" "This is why. What you're doing right now." Martin was stunned. The exchange had been so perfect. Of course, he understood the recent advances in mind-to-mind communication that were being achieved at Princeton, but that was with the help of implanted microchips. "No implants here, Dad." Trevor headed up the sharpening rise that separated them from the Saunders and the gateway. Martin looked ahead in his mind and saw the outriders still guarding the gateway and the water just a literal torrent. As soon as his mind touched them, though, every outrider turned this way and raised its forelegs. Some of them began to march. "Blank your mind. Go to your body." He forced his awareness into his flexing muscles, his feet, his heart, and lungs. Although he could no longer see the outriders in his mind's eye, he could still have clear awareness of them, and he knew that their alarm had subsided. To do this successfully, you had to be like animals were, looking out at the world without looking in at your thoughts. Not easy for a professor. "If you start to hear that rattling noise, stay in your body. Do not let your mind go out to it, or they'll be on you." Why was nobody else coming? This was obviously extremely dangerous, and more would be safer. Trevor glanced over at him. His eyes said it all. "This is my job. Our job." At that moment, they came up the rise, and Martin saw that the Saunders, even in just the past few minutes, had risen more. It had been bad before, but now it was a great surging mass of gray-black water full of trees, roofs, walls, floating staircases, even a car's wheels appearing and disappearing as it went tumbling downstream. Across the stream he could see their house, the windows dark, empty, and forlorn. The water extended almost to the front door, and water wasn't the only problem. 5 outriders lay curled up on themselves halfway down the ridge, ready to spring into action if anybody came into their range, and the ones on this bank still patrolled. "This is impossible," he said aloud. He was confused to see the water getting closer, looming up toward him. Then he realized that he was seeing it through Trevor's eyes. His son was scrambling down the bluff right toward the patrolling outriders and the thundering river. Martin raced down behind the last of his children, throwing himself forward, trying to reach him to at least get his attention. Whereupon one of the outriders on this bank turned from its patrolling and came straight toward him, but past Trevor, whom it did not seem to see. And indeed, Martin felt a surge of fear. He couldn't help it. The thing's metal fangs moved so fast that they sparked. "Run downstream, son!" Martin bellowed. He picked up a rock and threw it at the thing. It bounced off the head, causing it to rear back and hiss, and making 2 more of them come prancing toward him. To his utter horror, Trevor walked right into the flood. "Son! Son!" He could not escape the outriders, and Trevor was about to be killed. But he could escape. All he had to do was leave his fear, leave his mind, let himself happen. He paused in his headlong dash, closed his eyes, and emptied his mind. He put his thought on his roaring blood and the roaring water. His prayer came to him then, Franny's prayer, and joined itself to the whisper of his blood. When he opened his eyes, he found himself face to face with an outrider. Its eyes stared straight at him, its jaws moved slowly. Carefully, he stepped around it, then past another, so close that he could see that there was venom caked to its abdomen, and a stinger tucked in, the size of a butcher's meat hook. Trevor was now well out into the flood. Martin threw himself in and began swimming. The water grabbed him as a giant would, and he saw a great oak, stately, from somebody's yard over in Harrow, no doubt, come sweeping toward him, and with it death in the tangle of branches, drowning as he was swept away. Trevor still waded forward, though, and then seemed not to be wading, but walking. He was visible inside the water, but not affected by it, walking inside it. "Trevor!" Martin forced himself to dive to avoid the oncoming tree, forced himself to swim, felt the water ripping at him, and then saw Trevor beside him, walking easily as water and limbs and pieces of car and houses and bodies and drowned cattle went not only around him but through him. In the other world, of course, the stream wasn't in flood, so crossing this way would be easy. He looked down at his own body and saw that a great limb of the tree was moving through him, and a human arm, white and bloated, and a spatula, and dozens of poker chips, all passing right through him and leaving not the slightest sensation. A lawnmower went through him, then theater seats, a TV, a tangle of shrubs. He took another step forward, and the flood was gone. Instead, he was on the far side of the Saunders. Behind him, the little river flowed quite normally, tinkling faintly where it hurried across some stones. "Be very, very careful, Dad. I don't know what's going on up there." "I can't hear your thoughts. Not over here. It doesn't work." Martin looked back toward the Saunders. The bluff was there, but everything was quiet, washed with golden early sun. It was a view he'd looked at 1,000 times, and on summer Sundays heard from here the faint bells of the town. They had gone through the gateway, and on this side, in this universe, the Saunders wasn't in flood. "Come on, we've got to see what gives with that Hummer. It looks like typical Army issue. Their military's Hummers are all camouflaged. This is something the Seraph brought here." "They're here?" "Apparently." Trevor started off, moving quickly up the familiar hill toward the familiar house. As he walked behind his son, Martin experienced a sense of déjà vu so powerful that it was actually disorienting, even painful. This looked like home, and it felt like home, but it was not home. It was not home. Trevor stopped. "They're noisy," he said. "It's dead quiet. That's the problem. His car is in the garage, but it's just really quiet." He saw what looked like a sob in the open garage. "It's blue. Their cars have all sorts of different colors, blue, red, white." Martin had never heard of anything so outlandish. Who would be willing to drive around in a colored car? Cars were black. This Wiley must be an eccentric, which fit the literary pretensions, he supposed. Trevor approached the place cautiously, moving up the steep hill, his eyes always on that Hummer. Martin whispered as loudly as he dared, "Trevor!" His son motioned at him furiously. The message was unmistakable. "Shut up." Trevor dropped down on all fours, then onto his stomach. The Hummer was between him and the house, but he could almost certainly be seen if anybody looked closely enough. From the Hummer, definitely. Then he motioned again, this time indicating that Martin should come forward. Eagerness flashed through him. He jumped to his feet. Trevor's eyes widened and his mouth dropped open, and then there was a terrific crash and something went whanging off into the woods.
"Get your ass out of here!" a voice crackled. "We got you in crossfire, shitheel!"
A shot whipped past him so close that he felt a hot blast of wind. He threw himself to the ground. "No!" he called. "We're friends!" Another shot kicked up gravel beside his head. He tried his best to back away, attempting to reach the brow of the hill so that he could slide back down. But then a shot rang out behind him, and this one was closer, much closer. There was only one thing to do. He stood up and raised his hands. "Okay," he said. "Okay." From the woods came a boy's voice.
"It's a guy, Dad. A guy and a kid hiding by the Hummer. Back wheel."
Silence.
"We mean no harm," Trevor called. "Please, we need to talk."
The boy appeared coming up the far side of the driveway. He carried a big rifle, hefting it expertly. Martin realized what was happening here, that this was an historic meeting, the first contact between human beings from two different universes.
"Hello,"
Trevor said as he stood up. He walked out from behind the Hummer into full view of the house.
"Mr. Dale,
I'm Trevor.
You got the laptop? Wiley Dale asked.
No. This is my dad, Martin, Trevor said. We need to look at the book again.
The laptop was stolen. Plus, it's been rough around here, real rough. I haven't even thought about writing.
Martin realized that the smell he had been noticing was meat, and it was coming from the Hummer. As he walked closer, he could see blackened ruins in it, the shattered bodies of Seraph. And then, around the side of the house, one of the outriders. For a moment, he froze, but then he understood that they had destroyed it, too.
So, you're Trevor, Wiley said. Hey, Brooke, here's the people from my goddamn book come to life.
The boy had walked up to Trevor. Hiya, Nick, Trevor said.
Hey.
Nick put his hand out. Trevor looked at it.
Can we?
Dunno.
Martin watched. Wiley watched. His wife, Brooke, watched. A little girl's voice said from behind the very lovely mother,
Barish thinks it's okay.
Barish? Winnie had called her stuffed toy Barish, too. As the mother and daughter came closer, Martin saw that her Barish wasn't a zebra, but an elephant.
He's crying, Mommy.
They've lost Winnie and Lindy, Brooke said. You know that, honey. You know what they've lost.
What happened here?
Trevor asked.
You better get inside with us, Wiley said.
The house showed signs of a terrific fight. Martin was quietly astonished. These people were unhurt, obviously, but there had been a lot of killing around here, a lot of it. The rugs had blood on them, and he thought he saw a bloody body wrapped in a sheet behind the couch.
There's been a spot of bother around here, boys, Wiley said. But me and mine, we did 'em.
He drew a long brown object out of a pocket of his heavy leather jacket.
Cigar?
Martin watched in silence, unsure of what exactly was meant. The intonation of the unfamiliar word had suggested a question. Was it some sort of offering? There must be differences between the universes. Obviously, there would be. Look at the colored cars. But this was perplexing. Surely it wasn't a sacrificial offering. They must be past that.
I think I've earned house rights, Wiley said.
Wiley,
Brooke strode to him, threw her arms around him. You are the most amazing damn man, she said. Smoke your lungs out, lover.
Ew, Mommy.
He inserted the thing in his mouth, produced a book of matches, and lit the free end of it. He gave Martin another glance.
It's a Partagas, straight out of Fidel's humidor.
It's tobacco, Trevor explained. They burn it and eat the smoke.
But it's powder. Snuff is powder. Nick said,
Dad, I don't think they have cigars.
Nick regarded Martin.
Do you know what he's doing?
Then he frowned.
Jesus, look at their eyes. You haven't read my book as well as you imagine, son, Wiley said as he ate smoke, or rather, breathed it.
Martin enjoyed snuff, but he didn't care to join the hordes with cancer of the sinuses, so he'd sworn off. No doubt this method eliminated that problem. They could smoke the tobacco he guessed without fear of health problems.
Your friend Fidel makes those things?
Well, he's dead, but yeah, they're genuine Cubans, imported all the way to Kansas City.
Tobacco is legal in our world, but it's dangerous. It's sold in a powder called snuff.
Dangerous here, too. These suckers are really cancer sticks, but I do love 'em.
Ask him about Fidel Castro, Brooke said.
I have no idea who that would be, Martin replied. Do you know Trev?
No.
Nick said,
Cuban dictator, died a few years back, communist.
Communist, as in, Trev, can you help me here? A 19th century philosopher called Carl Lenin invented a system of labor management that became a huge movement in this universe.
Dad,
They've had total chaos here for over a century. That's why they're so tough. It's why there are dead Seraph and Outriders all around this house, and these people put fire in their mouths. In this universe, human beings have been at war so long, they've become incredibly strong.
No wars in your universe? Wiley asked.
No, Wiley, not really. The British and the French bicker over their African holdings, of course, and the Boer contingent is an irritant for the British in South Africa. The Russians had a war with the Japanese.
Wait a minute, he puffed on the cigar. Sarajevo, mean anything?
Martin couldn't think what it might be. He shook his head.
World War I? Wiley asked. World War II?
Martin was mystified. Dad, Trevor said, they have huge wars here. He pointed to a blood-spattered bookcase. War books, he said. I've read some of them.
Look, we've been at war on this little earth of ours ever since the Archduke Franz Ferdinand was assassinated in 1914.
An Archduke? Assassinated? That's hard to credit.
You still have them, don't you?
Of course. And Cuba is an American colony, and there is no Fidel in the colonial leadership, and this business of an obscure historical figure's gimcrack philosophy meaning anything.
Communism was the scourge of our world for 70 years, Wiley said. It took 500 million lives, and the world wars 300 million more. It's been carnage.
Martin looked at the wall of the family room, dominated by its gun case. We have too few of these.
You're not wrong there, Brooke said. Violence attracts violence.
Nick picked up what looked like a hand cannon that was lying on a table. He blew on the barrel.
Doesn't it, though, Mom? He said.
No child would ever address an adult like that at home, least of all one of his parents.
Wiley, Martin said, I'm wondering if you have any specific ideas about what we might do, given your own toughness.
The shitheels are tough, too, and we're likely to take a beating from 'em big time, and soon.
But you'll shoot.
Buddy, I seem to recall that your president tried a hydrogen bomb on Easter Island, and it didn't do jack shit. That isn't exactly a lack of aggression there, not by my definition, but the fact that it didn't work. When I wrote those words, I have to tell you that I felt sick. Real, real sick. Because a hydrogen bomb is the best we've got, too.
However, if your world is at war all the time, you won't have a British battle group demanding an explanation, will you? Not like us. By the time we got the superpowers to take an interest, it was all over.
The first wanderers were in England.
It takes a big empire like that a long time to act. In this case, too long, even if there was anything they could have done.
Wiley, Trevor asked, do you know why we're here?
You had a conference last night and decided that you wanted to open up direct communications. Problem is, I have no more idea than you do what's going to help. I mean, you are already looking at one hell of a mega disaster. I don't see how you can do anything. I have to tell you, I think you folks are done.
Trevor asked. Without the computer, can you still write?
No, kid, I cannot. I tried using Nick's laptop and Brooke's laptop and Kelsey's pink Mac, and nothing came. Nothing at all. Whatever magic there was, there ain't.
Which we sensed, Trevor said. And why we came. Because we knew that things were going wrong for you.
You people are so, I don't know, precise. The way you go about things, moving slowly from A to B to C. Do you think you might be a little slower than we are, mentally, not quite as smart?
We're not as aggressive, Martin said. Obviously, given all your wars, the communists, the smoke-breathing, which I interpret as domination symbolic.
Speak Greek. Your English is for shit.
Actually, I do have a little Greek. I've done some dig dating there, you see. Dating the Acropolis, which turned out to be non-controversial, unlike some of my other work.
Which I know all about, of course,
We have strange ruins here, too, same ones, plus very similar legends. A war in the sky, a great flood, all of that.
Meaning that they were here, too.
Mama, Kelsey asked, when are we going to kill the man in the crawl space?
What man? Trevor asked quickly.
Dad's got this really fucked up guy from your universe trapped in our crawl space. He's human, so we have this cop we know. He's on his way to take a look.
It's Al North, isn't it? General North?
He's in rather iffy shape, Wiley said. But I'm not going to go killing people without the cops say it's okay, if you get my drift.
Could we question him? Trevor asked.
Sure. Waterboard the fucker for all I care.
He sucked on the cigar, pulled it out of his mouth.
Use this on his eyes. Make him chatty as hell. Be my guest.
Trevor took the thing from him, held it. How would we? Nick laughed. Wiley said,
waterboarding is a form of torture. Makes the chappie you're curious about think he's drowning. And as far as that cigar you're holding is concerned, boy, you stick the business end of that thing in the sore eye socket General Al is nursing, my guess is he'll tell you more than his address.
Trevor thrust the thing away from himself.
Wiley caught it before it could touch the floor. Cuban, remember?
He sucked it, made a great cloud of smoke. A thing of beauty. He got up and strode across the room and into the kitchen. Martin reflected that he might be a writer by trade, but he had the speed and power of a soldier about him. The boy did, too. And with her hard-set lips, the woman looked as if she could kill a man as soon as look at him. Only the little girl seemed vulnerable. Or perhaps that was just because her cuddle toy was also called Bearish, and Winnie had been such a gentle child. Wiley opened a trap door.
How you doing down there, General? We're going to torture you in a minute. Just want to let you know. He closed the trap. It's called softening him up.
He's not playing with a full deck, Dad, Nick said.
Always remember this, son. If they're just playing with a half a deck, it don't matter as long as it's your half, or even one card, if it's the card you need.
We have no idea how to deal with Al North, Nick said.
And neither do they.
Silence followed. It was true enough. Wiley opened his cell phone, dialed.
Where in fuck's name are you, Matthew? I just finished your last Partagas, incidentally. He listened. Well, I'm telling you, the weirdness index up here has just shot through the roof. You need to put the frickin' donut back in the frickin' box and get your ass moving.
He hung up.
You know, I'm not saying a whole lot on the phone, so he thinks I'm bullshitting him some way. But I gotta tell you, he stopped.
Suddenly the bravado blew away like so much sea foam. He closed his eyes, shook his head.
I saved my family, he said softly. Me and my boy did.
Then he sat down. He took a long drag on the cigar. A truck came bounding up to the house, its gears grinding as it negotiated the steep driveway. It came to a stop.
Ah, wait until the gentleman of the law does his body count.
A tall man in a police uniform opened the front door and came in, using the same striding, aggressive walk that, it seemed to Martin, characterized them all.
What in hell kind of a Hummer is that? He said as he entered.
Then he sniffed the air. He looked toward Brooke.
He dope you up or something?
He's getting a reward for saving our lives.
From what? Some drug dealer's fancy Hummer? Man, that's a U.S. Army vehicle, full scale. You don't see many of those puppies around, and in limo paint, no less.
He looked at Wiley.
Don't tell me you purchased that thing. Buddy, that is going to piss me off. Matt, I want you to turn around and look at that man standing in front of the fireplace trying not to wet his pants. I want you to look into his eyes and tell me what you see there.
The lean, narrow-faced man turned, and as he did,
Martin saw that he did not carry a small firearm like Bobby, but a gun almost as big as the family's hand cannon. Martin looked to the pistol and the great ham of a hand dangling beside it, then, reluctantly, up to the face. He let Matt look into his eyes.
"What happened to you?"
It's a rapid evolutionary change induced by extreme species stress," Wiley said. "That would be correct, wouldn't it, Martin?"
"I would say so.
But, excuse me, I don't think we've been introduced." He thrust out his hand. "I'm Matt. Hi."
"Hi."
"You..." He motioned with his chin, an expressive gesture. "That's right. We're from over there. This is my son, Trevor."
"So you're the one lost Lindy and Winnie."
"Oh, Jesus, you poor guy." "Matt, I would recommend a very stiff scotch, but we don't have time. What we do have is one of his compadres tied up in our crawl space, a very weird, very altered piece of work that used to be a general over there in their version of the U.S. Air Force, but is now a sort of monster designed to be able to function freely in both universes, apparently by being made into a cut-up mess. You wouldn't believe it. I mean, you remember the guy downstate with the mutilated face? Nunnally?
Sure do.
The missing pieces have been sewn onto this man."
"What?"
"Sewn onto him, to provide a physical connection with our universe, give him greater freedom of action, the theory. In fact, bullshit. It's the Seraph who have trouble moving around in our universe, not people. And he's people. Was."
"Okay, I'm getting an occasional word. There is a man in your crawl space that has Nunnally's body parts."
"In a misbegotten attempt to enable them to function more freely in our universe. And this is Martin and his kid."
"Yes, sir."
Matt looked at them again. He held out his hand. Martin shook it.
"Wow," Matt said. "You sure this is for real, Wiley?"
"Oh, yes. And what we need is for Frankenstein down in the cellar to tell these people something."
"What, Martin? What might he know that would help you?"
"If we could stop the Seraph coming through, that would help us. If we could understand how to close their gateways, that would help us. Anything at all."
"You've read the part about Samson's journey to Abaddon?" Wiley asked. "Do you see a vulnerability there anywhere?"
"They're in a hurry, so we need to slow them down," Martin replied.
"Thing is, I also keep seeing an ending to my book, and in it I see these filthy, huge cities full of starving Seraph, and they are in your world. I do not see New York and Washington and London. Sorry, fellas, but I just don't. What I see there is open ocean. Right now, looks like you lose."
"Can this man extract information? Does he know these techniques?" Martin asked.
"He knows them, Martin," Wiley said. "He's served in the Mideast in his time."
"So you'll torture General North for us?"
Martin asked.
"I can't do that," Matt burst out.
"You got it, buddy," Wiley said. "Because once the Seraph finish with these guys, we're next."
"We'll cut their hearts out," Matt muttered.
"What we've been through here, believe me, it will be mutual. No, we don't want to have them show up here, believe me. And this North cat is the key. So you are going to help us. You are going to devote 5 minutes to this effort."
"It's totally illegal."
"He doesn't exist in this universe, therefore has no legal standing. Therefore, Nick, go get your skateboard. I think we can do this with a skateboard and a towel."
"I am not going to waterboard a goddamn general in any goddamn Air Force."
"Yeah, you are."
Wiley pulled the trapdoor open. A stench of urine and blood rose from the crawl space. He looked inside.
"Good morning again, General. Visitors."
General North's eyes stared. His chest did not move. Wiley knew it at once. Al North was dead.
Chapter 20.
December 20th. The Good Soldier. General Al North had never experienced pain like this. Although he had seen torture in Lebanon, men getting phosphorus splinters jammed under their fingernails and lit, he did not think for a moment that their pain, as awful as it was, approached this. He was screaming. He knew that objectively, as if from a distance, but he also knew that no sound was coming out. He'd come into this strange place, a parallel universe, he had come eventually to realize, faithful to his orders, to carry out an assassination. He'd never expected to be asked to do such a thing, but this was war, and we were desperate, and the military and intelligence communities were in chaos, so yes, he got why he had been called upon, and he resolved to do his duty. Something is wrong. He lay listening to the voices overhead. The man he had been sent to kill had proved to be a tiger, and his son was just as ferocious. Very frankly, they had overpowered Al, who was not a small man, and had excellent personal combat skills. He had not expected an adversary ready, willing, and able to gouge out eyes with his bare hands, or a child who would pick up a damn handgun the size of an anvil and just literally blow a grown man's guts out. A child. They're not the enemy. What was that? It was like part of his mind was yelling at him from behind a closed door. He had to get the hell up and get back out there, because those folks needed killing, and they were still walking around. He was going to do them all, massacre them, the women too, kill them all. Don't! Yeah, that's great. Disobey a lawful order transmitted to you in person by your commanding officer, who also happened to be the acting commander-in-chief. He did not like Tom Sampson, never had. The president had made a grave mistake giving him his appointment, but this was wartime, and they'd just about had it, and under such circumstances you have no choice but to trust your superior officer. You trust your own soul. That voice, it was saying something. Soldier, perhaps. Soldier, you're dying. That's what it was saying. He had not completed his mission, and he had to get out of this hole and do the damn deed. He fought to rise, could not. He closed his working eye, took a breath, then pressed downward with both hands. Rivers of agony swept up and down his arms and through his bubbling chest. His head went light. He fell back. His heart was thundering. Below the waist, no sensation at all. He'd seen others in the house. He'd seen a Hummer come up. It was them. Them! It had been some kind of an enemy unit. He could see that. But even they had taken a hell of a beating from these people. The mother cut up some of their exotic weaponry with a damned axe, and the little girl, what, 7, 8, stood there watching and laughing. Mommy's killing a big spider. Tough son of bitches. That was an outrider, and outriders belong to the enemy, soldier, and you are working for them, and you need to face this. The trapdoor was opened again. Light swamped his eye for a moment, then he saw a silhouette. This man isn't dead. This man is breathing. Another head appeared, disappeared. Fuckaroo, he's right. The woman's voice. Kill him. You can't do that, Brooke. I gotta call EMS. I gotta try to save his life. And, gee Christ, you got a man all shot to hell in your crawl space, so nobody leaves. Got that? Nobody leaves. It was self-defense. He attacked us. I know that, but I got procedures, buddy. This is serious. He's from our universe, another voice said. General North listened to them up there, murmuring together. Those bastards had figured out how to get through a gateway, and they were going to mess this whole operation up. You're not sad about that. You're glad. It's good. It's a triumph, for God's sakes. Listen to your soul. His mind cast about, trying to find a way to carry out his orders. There had to be one. There always was. There were guns upstairs, plenty of them. But down here there was nothing, only dirt. His own gun was long gone. So, did he have anything else that might cause damage? Belt, sure, but he wasn't going to be able to garrote anybody. Pins on his medals, big deal. Teeth, he could bite, maybe damn hard. So there was that. He could bite through one of their cheeks and clutch with his left hand. He tested it, yes. So, he needed them to pull him out. He'd take it from there. He waited. Nothing. No more voices that he could hear. Stomping that faded, then faint shouts. They were looking at whatever the intelligence unit had done. So they'd called EMS, and now that was done, they were showing the cop the rest of the damage around the house. Not good. He needed them to pull him up before some EMS bunch showed up to spirit him away. He took a breath, deep as he could, and let his pain possess him. He knew how to manage pain, and he'd been doing that, but now it was time to change his approach. As he let out the breath, he made himself scream. It worked amazingly well, damned well. He took another breath, did it again. The sound was odd, a lost, banshee-like howl, and it caused the river of pain to start flowing again. It also caused the trap door to open. "EMS will be along directly," the new voice said. Then that other voice again, somehow gentler, thinner. "He's from our world, and he's evil. You have to let us—" "I don't have to let you do one damn thing, Dr. Winters. This man is shot, he is here, and what you have to do is let me do my job. He's a criminal in our world, wearing a military uniform but working for the enemy. He belongs to us." "Don't you push me," Matt said. "Hey, guys, knock it off," Wiley responded. "Martin, you've got gumption after all." "We need to take that man back with us," Martin insisted. "Sounds like you need to take the whole damn Marine Corps." "We had a Marine Corps, too. Did you know that? And they are gone. Gone. The military was done in the first wave. Worldwide. Done. So unless we can stop the Seraph, they are coming here, tout suite." "Matt, fellas, I'm going to show my piece here in a second, and I do hate to do that. Did you know that you have an equivalent in our universe, who is also a lifelong friend of mine, just like you are of Wiley's? His name is Bobby. He's disappeared, and we think he's wandering, alive, but without a soul." "And you will be too," Trevor added, "if they come here, wandering, with your soul locked up just like Wiley has seen. Or worse, you'll be like that man down there, so twisted and turned around that he works for the enemy and thinks he's working for his own kind. You'll be just like that, and possibly within days. Look, this shooting is the most serious thing to happen in this town in my entire career.
You should see the one my mommy shot. It looked like a big spider, and when she blasted it, it sent out hot stuff that smelled like when you burn bacon."
"Listen to them. They're your friends." He sucked another breath, howled another howl. "Let us take him back," Trevor pleaded. "Let us find out what we need to know."
"You can question him in the hospital," Matt offered.
Wiley laughed scornfully. "Oh, for shit's sake, Matthew, this cat needs to be waterboarded. At the very least, he needs a live rat stuffed in that eye socket. At the very freaking least. Hospital? Do you put a goddamn cobra in a hospital?"
"If you're me, you sure as hell do. In an animal hospital. Departmental requirement. All injured animals are provided treatment."
"That is not what I meant."
The ambulance was coming soon, so Al had to make a maximum effort here, a super effort, or this was not going to come out right. He had more than one job to do, he knew that now, because he had to kill every one of these damn people, especially the ones from his own universe. How had things gone so wrong? He had to kill them and get back and warn General Sampson that things were out of control. They were way out of control.
Then the cop came down into the crawl space. Just like that, he was standing over him. This was his chance, his only chance. As the fool bent down, he reached up and pushed the pistol out of the holster with the heel of his hand. It hit his thigh with a thud that shook him, but which he didn't feel. "Excuse me," the cop said, reaching down. Al was faster. Al got the butt of the weapon between thumb and forefinger. He felt along the side of it and got his finger around the trigger. He raised the weapon.
"Shit! He's got my gun! He's got my fucking—"
He shot upward wildly through the door. There were cries from above. He had no way to know if he'd hit anybody, so he shot again and again until there was only one bullet left. By now, the cop had skittered back up there too, and they were all yelling. He knew what he had to do because he knew the stakes. They needed information that he did indeed possess, and it sounded as if they were going to drag it out of him with pliers. They would succeed, too. Our expertise at torture was child's play compared to what these bastards sounded capable of.
Give it to them. Tell them everything.
There was one gateway they knew nothing about, but he knew about it because he'd been taken through it, and they were not going to find that out. They couldn't destroy the Seraph, not even close, but they might slow things down. And that was the issue, wasn't it? Because every day after the 21st, things were going to get harder, and around the 25th, the gateways would once again close, and Abaddon would be denied all but minor access for another 13,000 years. They'd have to go back to sending through agents provocateurs to derange human civilization, cause wars, spread starvation and greed and confusion, and keep the bastards weak.
Keep your people weak, you mean. Listen to yourself, General. You're thinking with the enemy.
He got the barrel of the gun nestled under his chin, prayed to the good Lord above that he had killed the man he'd been sent to kill, and pulled the trigger. Then he climbed up out of the crawl space and into the kitchen. Wiley, whom Al had been sent to kill, was unhurt. They were all unhurt. And Al was elated. The next second, he understood that the person still lying down there in that crawl space with a splayed head was him, and all at once he realized what he had done.
Hey! Oh, Jesus, I'm sorry! Sorry!
He remembered the mountain, going down into the rock with that woman, Captain Maisel. He realized that she had been Seraph. Samson was one of them, too. They were heavily disguised, and they used drugs to enable them to live in our air. And they had stolen his will. Needles, sharp scissors, clipped flesh wobbling in silver trays, brain being removed, brain being installed. They had stolen his memory. They had subverted his honor.
This soldier owes his duty to his country, not to them.
He'd been working for the enemy. As he watched, EMS technicians came running in. He watched them jump down into the crawl space.
"I can tell you what you need to know," he said.
The cop hurried out behind the EMS doctors. Wiley and his family came together, holding each other. Martin and Trevor left and began to move off down the hill.
Al ran outside.
"Wait, listen to me. I made a mistake, but I can help you."
He went up to them. He shouted into Martin's face.
"Listen to me. I can help you."
Nothing. He grabbed Martin, and his hands went right through him. Martin shuddered and said, "I feel like a goose just walked over my grave. Dad, we have a problem here, because when we go back, we're going to hit really fast water. Remember, in our world, the Saunders is in flood." Al could hear every word.
"Can you hear me?"
he bellowed.
"Yeah, that's right. We can't cross. Not with the flooding on the other side.
What about the Hummer?"
"Yeah."
"No, no, you fools. It'll float right down the river."
They started back up the hill.
"It's full of dead Seraph. Take 'em with us. Save Wiley and Matt a lot of trouble. Plus, the back's caked with venom. They must have brought that busted-up outrider with them in it."
Al had followed them. He was right with them, just inches away.
"Listen to me! Listen now!"
They set about pushing reptile bodies into the back of the Humvee. Al inventoried his situation. "You still exist. You can think. You can see and hear. You can move effortlessly wherever you want to go. But how in hell do you communicate?" A quick review of his knowledge of ghosts and such, and the answer was immediately clear. You don't. He was a damn ghost, was what he was. But no. This ghost was no cute little Casper, and, he hoped, no raging banshee. He had a much larger vision of his life than before. His conscience was very, very powerful now. He saw deep into the arrogance that had made him who he was, the entire falsity of it, and how profound feelings of worthlessness were the foundation of the ego that had led him across all his life, all the way to this final predicament. He knew now who he was. He knew the mistakes he had made, and he knew just exactly how to help the people of his world turn everything around. They could completely defeat Abaddon. These people, this man and this boy, if only they knew what he did. He had to tell them, but he couldn't make them hear him or see him. Martin and Trevor opened the doors of the Hummer and shoved two gray, lifeless Seraph bodies into the back. Then, as an afterthought, Trevor pocketed one of their hand weapons. Al knew those weapons, electrical centrifugal handguns that could propel thousands of lightweight plastic rounds at 5,000 clicks an hour. The only sound they made was the crackle of the rounds breaking the sound barrier, but they could slice a man in half a mile away, or a dozen men, or 1,000.
"How do these work?" Martin asked.
"Let's test them."
"Holy shit, be careful."
"It doesn't look very lethal," Trevor commented. Martin held one of the black discs away from his body, pointing its three short barrels in the direction of some trees. He pressed the two triggers, top and bottom. There was a brief snarl, and three of the trees literally flew apart. A foot-wide chunk of their trunks turned instantly to sawdust.
"What is this thing?" "The U.S. military has the same thing. Bigger, vehicle-mounted."
"It's a Seraph weapon," Trevor said, producing a dark blue box with Seraph hieroglyphics on it.
"Here's some ammo. Wiley and Nick would love this."
"You like them. They're macho and their guns and all."
"They're winners, Dad. This whole universe, it works better than ours. It's more dynamic.
It's been at war with itself for 100 years,
and we live in a world of kingdoms and empires where nobody's really free."
"We're free. We are, and the French are, and the English are, at least at home. But look at the rest of it, Dad. It's a vast system of slavery. Orderly, easy to live in, but..."
The Hummer roared to life.
Al watched, no longer trying to stop them. He knew that he couldn't. The dead did not communicate with the living. Just didn't.
"So when you finally understand and you can tell them everything they need to know, this happens."
They closed the doors and drove the Hummer down toward the bank of the Saunders, here flowing gently. There were places where you could jump across it even, but certainly not into another universe. They needed to know about the Seraph headquarters, deep underground and just a few miles from here, had to be told what he had remembered about being in there.
If they could enter it, they could free millions of trapped souls. They could wreck the power systems, maybe even stop the lenses from functioning. They could cause core damage to Abaddon's plans, maybe kill Maisel and Samson even. He raced down to the Hummer, shot into it right through one of the windows.
"Hear me! Hear me!"
"There's the gateway," Martin told Trevor. "Is it big enough for this thing? They got it through." Maybe this was good. Maybe the gateway was too small. Maybe the Hummer wouldn't fit and they wouldn't kill themselves, the damn fools. Do we just aim at it or what? I'm not sure I know how to go about this. I'm not sure either, Dad. Don't try, please. We have to try. Please. As Martin backed the Hummer up, Al did everything he could think of, attempting to project his thoughts into Martin's mind, actually going inside his body where his organs were sloshing and his blood was surging. He went directly into the brain, but even that didn't help. He could perceive the gray matter, like a pulsating, sparking fog all around him, but he couldn't do anything to affect thought from in here either. The Hummer went roaring toward the gateway. Al saw the diamond-shaped crystalline object much more clearly than he'd been able to in life, and saw it expand smoothly, almost obediently, to accommodate the Hummer. So it was going to go through. They were going to be in it, and they were going to be drowned. He saw black water, roiling, churning, and in it what looked like people swimming hard. Then the Hummer hit with a huge splash, and the gateway closed and was gone. He was moving fast and sailed right across the stream and into the woods beyond, but he was still in this universe. He rushed back across the river, looked for the gateway, could not find it. But he didn't belong here. This wasn't right. He rushed up and down the riverbank, trying to find a flicker of the gateway. Even when he'd seen the president die and known that Samson had somehow done it, he had not acted. Instead, he'd gone to Cheyenne Mountain to take a new job because he'd wanted the promotion. What had he been thinking? How could he have so blinded himself? In this state, he was finding that he was becoming naked to himself, seeing past the self-deception that had defined his life. He was seeing how loveless, how empty it had been, a useless, silly journey, his wife dead early and no further attempt to find love, and love all that mattered. In this state, he was revealed to himself, and he saw clearly that his willful blindness had led to a great catastrophe, and there was no way for him to justify himself. He found himself back a very long time ago, sitting on the side porch at home on a night in July, with music drifting across the evening air. He saw a girl he had known then, a girl called Nellie, who had been full of love for him. Had he let himself accept her, had he chosen the humble life that being with her offered, he would be soaring now, flying above all these cares, instead of sinking into this pit of regret. He wasn't just sinking into despair, either. He was becoming involved with the actual ground. He was sinking into the earth itself. Above him, he could sense realms past imagining, where things like the walls between universes had no meaning, and time itself was only a memory. He was falling, but he wanted to rise. He had to rise. It was heaven. He was seeing heaven, and he had to rise. Then he thought of the souls Samson had trapped. They belonged there. They were part of heaven, but they had literally been stolen from God to be bought and sold, their memories and emotions stripped from them like ripe fruit and consumed into the darkness of demon hearts. It was the greatest of all evils, to kidnap the good into hell. But that's what they were doing, or rather, trying. He would fight. He would do battle with Samson. but he was already lower, sinking into the grass, and below him he could see black halls and hear desolate cries. He strove, he struggled, he fought. Above him, love and forgiveness shimmered. Above him, freedom beckoned. He tasted the greatest agony there is, that of being unable to rise to heaven. But then, he thought, perhaps he could save himself. There was something he could do, perhaps. One thing. Wouldn't work, probably. But he could try.